Now, Carlos spoke very, very clearly about the asymmetries of benefits and burdens that are created by the present patent system. But mention was also made of the Doha Agreement and, of course, equally important, in August of 2003, the decision taken as to the TRIPS Agreement that brought about the capability that you heard of, which is the ability of countries that cannot manufacture medicines to import the medications under a compulsory license that is exercised against a patented medicine by a generic manufacturing process in a country that does have that capability, the generic capability. And so I guess one of the questions that one has to ask is, why hasn't this been used? We've been 2 years past that August decision. And what is it about the circumstances? It cannot be that there isn't the need in many of the countries that we've heard for drugs at reasonable prices. So what has happened? Why haven't we seen the exercise of that compulsory licensing power and the filing of the necessary statements to indicate that the importing countries are going to do that? Canada, of course, has passed a law that would allow it to be the manufacturing country. But as far as I know, we haven't seen the comparable statements from the other countries. And so those three questions then, why focus on medications if we're focusing on human rights and not on the many more basic determinants of well-being and health, broadly conceived as it is by the WHO Constitution? Why haven't we seen this exercise under the August 2000 decision? And finally, are companies, the ones who have the actual power in many of these situations, are they now bound by the human rights instruments? Thank you.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Thomas first.
Okay. If I had a chance to say one thing to governments, I think I would probably just pass it up, because I don't think that governments are responsive to moral arguments in particular. But if I had a chance to talk to ordinary people who might influence governments, I think I would single out this issue that we are now discussing. And I would single it out because I think that here we have a fortuitous combination of feasibility, practicability, with political realizability. It's very, very difficult to change institutions, and it's certainly very, very difficult to change them at the global level. But with this kind of institutional change, I think there are unique opportunities to actually bring change about. Partly because the moral issues are so incredibly stark. It is so completely obvious that we cannot let millions of people die because drug prices are so high and they must rely on money that they simply don't have to gain access to these drugs. So it's a morally obvious issue. It's an issue that deeply embarrasses the pharmaceutical industry, as illustrated by that famous April 2001 case where they turned tail in South Africa. James mentioned it. It's deeply embarrassing for them. And if we find a somewhat different way of incentivizing pharmaceutical innovation, in particular for medical problems affecting the developing countries and poor populations there, then we could actually give new profit opportunities to pharmaceutical companies and make them our allies. So there's a pull and a push factor. Pharmaceutical companies are deeply embarrassed by the status quo, and they might gain new profit opportunities if we can find a different way of organizing the patent system. So this is one of the weak links of the existing global institutional order, where a relatively small change that wouldn't cost very much in economic terms would have a simply phenomenal impact and payoff in human terms. And that's why I think it's a very good issue to focus on. Briefly on the two others, why hasn't compulsory licensing been used? I think, roughly speaking, what we have is a system where intellectual property rights are gaining grounds all the time, because the rich countries, who are mainly interested in collecting more and more rent for their so-called intellectual property, are buying protection for their intellectual property rights in other countries by granting limited market access to their otherwise highly protected markets. So despite all the free market rhetoric, as we all know, there are enormous protectionist barriers to entry into the rich countries through tariffs, anti-dumping duties, quotas, export credits, subsidies to domestic producers, and so on. These heavily protected markets are opened a little bit in exchange for enforcement of intellectual property rights. So by granting compulsory licenses, you are displeasing very rich countries with big markets, and the little countries are afraid of displeasing them and thereby losing market access, which they urgently require, and which, of course, market access to the rich countries is something that benefits the richer segments of poor countries who have more political influence, whereas enforcement of intellectual property rights in pharmaceuticals harms, in particular, the poorest segments of the poorer countries, which have no political influence. So no wonder the elites in the poorer countries say it's more important to us to have more market access, and even if we have to pay the price of enforcement of intellectual property rights, than the other way around. Now, with regard to companies, I would say that, of course, companies are bound by human rights, but the solution to the problem is not to appeal to companies and brand them as human rights violators. The solution is to change the rules under which these companies operate. Corporations in a capitalist economy will essentially be profit-maximizing enterprises, and that's not a bad thing if the rules under which they operate are properly designed. We can design these rules in such a way that companies will be appropriately incentivized, that essentially their profit motive will coincide with moral constraints and moral desiderata, and that's what we have to do. We can't design the rules in such a way that the profit motive of companies is overwhelmingly pulling them in the direction of violating human rights and then complain that they do.
James, I think.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick comments to your replies to your questions. Should healthcare or should access to medicines be the first focus of an effort to improve health? Well, I think the answer to that lies in your second point, which is that the single largest cost increase in delivering healthcare services lies in drugs. There's no question that there are broad determinants of health care, of health. There's also no question that government has a role in terms of providing a systems response to increasing health care of its populations. And if that systems response is being utterly consumed by increasing costs of drugs, then that's where you have to target in terms of actually addressing the substantive issues in terms of public capacity. And as you rightly pointed out, the increase in the cost of drugs is not just an issue for the developing world. It's very much an issue for the developed world. And in Canada, the average increase in costs for drugs are around somewhere between 13 and 18% per year of our overall healthcare costs. And that's what's driving the crisis in access to healthcare in Canada, is the cost of drugs. So, and in the developing world, other issues like infrastructure and so on, infrastructure to deliver healthcare, these other issues cannot even be reasonably broached are reasonably examined if the possibility of delivering a drug does not actually exist because the drugs are so expensive. Right? So the issue of addressing drugs as the primary focus of campaigns and of activists and of movements around the world that are focused on improving health care, I think it's front and center. It must be the central issue. You also raise the question, why has the monotext that followed the Doha Declaration, why has that not actually been used? Well, Jamie Love is here, and he may actually have a good answer to that, and Carlos may also have a very good answer to that. But my understanding is that following the MATA text of August 2003, several countries have actually started a process to change their national legislation to allow for production of generic or export of generic versions of patented medications, Canada being one. Through Bill C-9. India has already passed its own legislation like Canada. Holland is considering legislation. France is considering legislation. And the EU as a whole is considering a change to some of the governance structures that affect production of generic versions of medications. I know for a fact that in Canada there are two, I can't talk about the details, but there are two specific initiatives underway. To use Bill C-9 to actually produce generic versions of patented drugs in Canada for export to the developing world. And the final point I'd like to make is that you asked about you addressed the issue of should multinational companies, and particularly in this case pharmaceuticals, be bound by human rights conventions. And let me just say something that might be shocking to you. No, they shouldn't be. What should happen, though, is that governments should be setting the rules of the game. What we're actually talking about here today is the role of government. Is government simply an administrative structure that enables a free market and that allows for free market forces to run unfettered and in a manner that creates wealth? Or is the role of government something else? And in my view, the role of government, and this really is the basic ideological argument, the role of government is to promote, to protect, and in some cases, provide for public goods. In the case of the pharmaceutical industry, it is the responsibility of government to ensure that the pharmaceutical industry behaves in a manner that meets public objectives. If the pharmaceutical industry, for example, through market forces or market failure, is unable to create new innovative drugs that target diseases that occur largely in the South, that's not the pharmaceutical industry's fault. That's the government's fault. And it's a failure of governance. And so what we need is an institutional architecture, essentially, that recognizes that fundamental role of government. And that means when market forces or private sector actors or other private actors are unable, through the regulation of a market or through the regulation of a society, are unable to actually achieve public goods, then government must actually provide that public good. And in fact, if you look at the history of the development of, for example, drugs for tuberculosis, came out of public institutions. Antiretrovirals, in fact, the research for antiretrovirals came out of public institutions. And it was patented by the pharmaceutical industry under a fairly complex system. But the basic research was conducted in public institutions. And in my mind, that's the role of government, is to ensure that public goods are promoted, protected, and then, in fact, provided if there aren't other means of doing so.
And the last word to Carlos.
Well, thank you. Why are you making so difficult questions so late? Let me address the last one, the issue of the role of governments. I may be very provocative, but I would say that in some cases governments are in the companies, when they negotiate intellectual property issues or impose certain rules on intellectual property on developing countries. I would say that the laws that are being imposed on developing countries in the area of intellectual property are in fact written in the law firms that advise the pharmaceutical companies, if not in the pharmaceutical companies themselves. And I can tell you my personal experience. I have been involved in negotiations with the United States on issues relating to intellectual property. And it happens that those people, or those negotiators from the United States, after being very tough about the protection of patents and the interests of the pharmaceutical industry, suddenly it is known that they have left the government and they work for pharmaceutical companies. I can mention you the names of a number of people that, after concluding very sensitive negotiations in which issues relating to public health and pharmaceuticals were involved, left the government, and one of them is vice chairman of one of the major pharmaceutical companies, and many of them hold jobs in these companies. And I think that there is a very important ethical issue. It is acceptable that this happens in such a way in which you are discussing today with somebody who represents the government, and the next day the same person is representing the company whose interest were very much pursued in such negotiations. In relation to the decision of August 2003, I don't know whether the audience is really acquainted with the decision. If you allow me, we'll just say a few words about this. The problem that ministers of trade face when they met in Doha, when the Doha Declaration was adopted. It is a situation in which you have a medicine which is patented all over the world. This means that if the price of the medicines is high for a particular country, the assumption is that there will be no other source in order to get that medicine. And this is very different from the situation we had before, in which, for instance, Indian companies were able to supply cheap medicines, and this made a major difference, in particular area in the area of antiretrovirals. But now that India has to comply with patents too, the scenario is one in which you have only one supplier with a patent which is granted all over the world, and therefore if you want to buy from the supplier and he said, this is my price, and you as a government cannot afford that price, what options do you have? So the option is what is called compulsory license. That means that the government may decide to use the invention or to allow somebody else to use the invention and pay a royalty to the patent owner in order to get the product manufactured and distributed at the lower price. The issue that the ministers of trade face is that you can use a compulsory license when you have manufacturing capacity in your country. If this possibility is allowed, let's say in a small African country, but there is nobody in that country able to manufacture the medicine, so the system does not work. You are still fully dependent on the patent owner. You can do nothing to avoid it. So this is why this decision was elaborated and adopted finally by the World Trade Organization, according to which in such a situation, when there is a country that needs a medicine, it cannot get an agreement with the owner of the patent, which charges a high price, then in that case, that country may import that medicine from another country. The problem is that in the exporting country, the mere manufacturing of the medicine, which is also patented there, might be an infringement to the patent. Therefore, there will be a situation in which there is no possibility of supplying from a different country. This decision, therefore, allows for the granting of compulsory license in both the exporting country and in the importing country. As it was mentioned, some countries such as Canada has already adopted legislation in order to implement this decision, which addresses the problem I've just tried to describe. Why the decision has not been used? I think that essentially the problem is that the system established by decision is extremely complex and cumbersome. There are so many requirements to be complied with. You need to grant two comparison licenses in the exporting and importing country. This may not be easy, in particular because there might be political pressures in order not to do that. There are a number of requirements that the supplier must comply with. And essentially, see, the problem, in my view, is that for generic companies, for instance, in Canada, it is not a good opportunity in commercial terms to develop from the very beginning the chemistry of the product, to develop the formulation of the product, to get approval of the product either in Canada or in the importing country in order to supply a small market. Therefore, the system that has been developed does not provide the incentives that the generic industry in Canada, in Netherlands, or in India would need in order to be suppliers under the system. And in my view, this is the major flaw of the decision. And I don't think we cannot expect this to change significantly in the short term.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go to the podium.